delta. If we make delta smaller and smaller, so increase the number of these slices, at some point we should not expect more of these kinetic energy jumps here. So we concluded, just based on the fact that the kinetic energy should be proportional to the number of particles, that the number of jumps has to be proportional to beta times n when you go to the limit of an infinite number of time slices, or let's say just large number of time slices. So that also means, of course, that the smallest number of time slices you can expect to have and still get some sort of good result should also be proportional to beta times n. So that's the size of the space, at least in the time direction. Okay, so keep that in mind. Now let's see what happens if we include interactions. So what we just talked about was just the kinetic energy. So if we have interactions, we have the kinetic energy and the potential energy in the Hamiltonian. So what we can do then, since the potential and kinetic energies don't commute, right, that's one issue here, we can use this so-called Trotter approximation or split operator approximation, splitting up this exponential of the sum of the two into two independent exponentials. And the error of that, I think you must have seen something like this before in your quantum mechanics courses. The error of that is delta t squared. So if we do that, then these matrix elements, since V is the potential energy, it's diagonal in the representation we use, we can just pull it outside. So this would be VL would be whatever the potential energy is in that state. We pull that outside. And then since we have many time slices, we get products of these kinetic matrix elements, and these are just numbers, so we can lump them together in one big sum, so just sum over all those time slices. And that would be now the weight of the path. So it would be still this delta, the number of the time slice width to the number of kinetic jumps, but then it's modified by this potential factor here. And again, I will not show it explicitly, but again, even with interactions, we get this exact same result as before for the number of kinetic jumps. One can still show that the kinetic energy is given by the number of jumps. So we should still expect the paths to have the same sort of jumping probability as you go up in that direction. So let's look at an example of an acceptance probability if we do Monte Carlo updates of these paths, these local updates. If we include, add two more of these jumps in a path, nk increases by 2, so the weight becomes normally smaller by a factor delta t squared, because delta is small normally. And then we get the ratio of these exponential, which I just call V new and old here. Yes, please.
Can you only, are we only considering distorting paths that are already straight then?
Okay, so this is just one example of a local distortion. You can imagine many things, and in the end, we will actually not use these. This is just for illustration of what we could do. So in the early days of quantum Monte Carlo, people did exactly things like that. And now later, as I will mention in a few minutes, we do much more efficient things where we distort the paths in much more dramatic ways.
The reason why I'm asking, though, is because is it necessary that that always increases the weight?
If you increase the number of kinetic jumps,
right,
you always get this delta here, and in fact the weight is decreased.
Well, that's what I mean.
Right.
But I mean, never mind. Sorry.
Anyway, we will get back to this. I think it will become clearer to you. So if we do this kind of let's say naive small modifications, there is actually a problem here, because if delta is small, you can see that this acceptance probability will typically be very small. But you can imagine that can be somehow compensated in principle for by the fact that we have many ways to do the distortions. This is just one way. So this is what you were somehow hinting at, I think. This is just one way, and there are actually many, many ways. And let me make that more systematic when we go to the continuous time limit. So we can actually take the limit. When we draw these pictures, it's clear. We just draw the pictures, and instead of having some discrete number of slices, we just draw them like this. So there's no longer any time slices here. We have taken the continuum limit. And the reason we can do that is exactly what we just concluded, that the number of these jumps that we expect should still be proportional to beta times n, even in the limit of an infinite number of slices. So in fact, what we can do, we can do this continuum limit and not store the whole patch. We can just store these events. So the amount of information we need to store is really just proportional to beta n, even when we take the continuum limit. Okay, but then we have the problem, how would we actually do the updates? Because now if we just take some specific part here and choose, you know, two points and try to make a kink. Formally, the acceptance probability for adding that kink is zero. What we can do is something which I try to illustrate here. So here would be some straight segment, and in principle, we could include a kink here, for example, to the left or to the right. And it could occur anywhere in between those other events. It could, of course, go past it too, but just as an illustration. So now what we can do is we can integrate the probability of inserting this kink anywhere in, for example, a straight region like that. And that will always be finite because there's an infinite number, if you will, of different places to put these guys. So once you have computed, which we will not do because, again, this is just in principle, in practice, we will not even do this. But in principle, you could compute the probability of having this thing somewhere, and then when you have computed that probability, the probability is equal for having them anywhere. So then you just put them at random. Okay, and one can do that in several different ways. And okay, so in principle, there's no problem with taking the limit. That's the whole point. But in fact, people that use these continuous time algorithms, they don't even use local updates because they're very inefficient. And in fact, there are so-called loop and worm updates of these configurations where you create some much more dramatic changes in the loops. And now we will discuss the stochastic series expansion method, and there we will also encounter exactly the same issues, and we will look at loop updates in that context. So now I want to, so this was like the background about path integrals in general, and now I want to switch to another representation of quantum statistical mechanics based on the Taylor expansion of this exponential. And although this starting point is quite different, seemingly, in the end you will see that it's quite similar. So we start with the Taylor expansion. So in principle, this is approximation free from the outset, unlike the previous version where we started with a discrete delta, so where there was some approximation. But now you may ask, well, this goes up to infinity, so how do we deal with that? So to answer that question in a simple setting first, before we go on, let me show you a simple just math example here. We take e to the minus x and write that as a Taylor expansion. So we get let's say it's plus x. It's a little easier because we don't have the sign. X to the n. Okay, this is the Taylor expansion, I hope, if I didn't make some serious mistake here. Now let's write it in this way. Let's just call these numbers W of n. And then let's normalize these weights W. So let's consider P of n, which is like a probability, is W of n divided by e to the x. So this is the relative weight of the term of order n in the expansion. And okay, now who can tell me if I plot this guy, of n. What will this look like? Yep, pretty much. And where will it be peaked? For what n will it be peaked? So it will indeed look zero. Right, x peak will actually be at, so we can say average n is more or less, I should say peak, but actually it will be exactly true. If you compute the average n, it will be exactly equal to x. And you can do that. So now the stochastic series expansion builds on something similar. Namely, okay, so since this decays exponentially here, if I take some L, and my L is much, it doesn't even have to be much, much larger, but let's say large enough larger than average n, I can truncate this at that number, and I will make an approximation which is completely irrelevant because this decays so fast. So if I just choose, let's say, L is 1.5 times average n or something, the error will be, you know, so small that you could never detect it if you do something numerical. So that's that's the point of this representation too, that we start with an expansion which formally goes up to infinity, but because we are dealing, of course, we have something which is more complicated than just a number x. But what we are dealing with is a finite inverse temperature beta, and also the lattice is finite. So in the end, it's quite similar to that. And now you may worry about signs here. So when I have e to the minus beta h, I have a minus beta here, so it looks like the signs will oscillate. But in fact, in the cases we can use this, which turns out to be exactly the cases where we could use the path integral as well, those signs will cancel out. So in the end, everything here will be positive. It's just that, well, because there are some signs in the Hamiltonian that will cancel that out, as we will see. So what we do now is something that will look similar to the path integral, in the sense that we have the partition function, and we have some power h to the n, and then we stick in these complete sets of states between those. In the path integral, when we started, we chose a fixed number of these slices, which I called L. Now, of course, this space is not fixed because we sum over this expansion order. So these factors will be of a varying number of matrix elements. But that's actually no big deal. We will see in a moment how to deal with that. So the difference, if we neglect the difference coming just from the fact that this is fluctuating, the difference is that when we did the path integral and we did the Taylor expansion to leading order, only first order of e to the minus delta tau h, we got this form. And those were the matrix elements we considered. Now we only have matrix elements of H. And now this goes back to Acosta's question yesterday, because you asked, why do we need the one there? And I told you, well, we of course need it because that's the leading term. But in this alternative formulation, we actually don't need the one. So that means if we look at the hardcore boson model, let me just, I know it's annoying when I flip back, but let me be a little bit annoying. If we go back to these pictures, what we do in the series representation is we have a variable number of slices here. And furthermore, there can never be, if we just consider the hardcore boson case, there would not be any slices with no event here. There would be something happening everywhere. Although, in a moment, we will actually change that. So in a moment, I will again make the space be of a fixed length, because you don't have to actually do that, but sometimes it's a little bit inconvenient that the space is fluctuating. But before doing that, let's look at the energy. Let's look at really the expectation value of the energy, or of the Hamiltonian. So this was the partition function. So when we compute some expectation value, again, we have to have a similar expression, but now we have another operator there, which we take the expectation value of. If we consider the energy, that's just another H. So if you look here carefully how I have labeled things here, in the partition function, these states go from 0 to n minus 1. But now in the numerator, I have an additional H, so I now label them up to n. So there's one more matrix element here than here for a given n. So now to write that in a way which I can evaluate Monte Carlo, I have to write the energy as a sum of weights times some estimator, and the weights should be exactly those numbers, because those should be those are the weights appearing in the partition function. So to get it in that form, I can do a very simple trick here. So you see, here I have n plus 1 states going from alpha naught to n, and here I had n. But really they look very similar, because it's just matrix elements of the Hamiltonian. So if I just relabel the summation here, so I just identify or just call n plus 1 equals, let's say, m, and then I rename m to n again, then I get it in this form, because then this n here will be m minus 1, and this is corrected here just by, so if you take this ratio, it corresponds to n minus 1 factorial, and this is beta n minus 1, and there's a minus sign in front of there. So now you see I have exactly the same, I can identify the weight here, which is everything here except that guy and that guy. So that means actually the expectation value, oops, I didn't need to do that yet. The energy, which is the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, is, and here I forgot the minus sign, minus the expectation value of n divided by beta. Right, okay. This looks a little bit similar to what we saw before for the kinetic energy. So if we rewrite it, we see that n, the expectation value, is proportional, well, it is equal really to beta times the energy, or the absolute value of the energy, because there's a sign there. And the energy, again, should scale proportionally to n. So from this we can conclude that the average expansion order is proportional to n times beta. So this is similar to what I did there on the board, that the average expansion order there was equal to x. And you see here it's similar, because here it's beta times the expectation value of h. So if you just put the expectation value here, you have exactly the same result as there, provided that we can actually neglect all these signs, provided that there are some signs in the Hamiltonian which cancels all signs here, which I will show in a moment that at least for some class of models is true. Yep. Oh yeah, let me get to that. C is the specific heat. So if you just, the specific heat is the derivative of the energy with respect to the temperature, and if you do that within these expressions, you actually get that the specific heat is basically the fluctuation of n, but minus the expectation value of n as well. And for example, we know that the specific heat normally goes to zero when the temperature goes to zero. So from that we also get that this is the fluctuation of n equals n. So, well, this is the square of the fluctuation. So what it means, if we go back to this picture, is that the width of this distribution is square root of n, which is square root of x. So the width is, if you imagine that this n, that x is large here, the width of the distribution is very narrow compared to the average. So the width is just the square root of the average. Any more questions? Yep.
I just wonder if we consider a finite system of saying
Yeah. Right. Well, but these states are all for the same system size. Right? I haven't specified the system size here, but these are for some system size n. So I'm not exactly sure what you mean, because they're, these basis states all refer to the same basis. Right. So. Yeah, I'm just thinking where the confusion came from. So the system size is fixed, beta is fixed. This is all same basis states. So in the end, if you draw pictures of this again, if I go back, well, let me go back in a moment, because I want to say one more thing here. So in practice, one can work with these fluctuating n configurations. So you would have some Monte Carlo updates that change the length of these configurations. One can also work with a fixed length space. So exactly as I explained on the board there, if you cut this expansion at some sufficiently high order, since the decay of this distribution is exponential, in practice you don't make an error. So let's cut it off somewhere. And it turns out, as we will see later today, one can make this cutoff self-determined by the program so that you can be sure that there is actually no error in it. But so let's assume we have a good L. Then what I want to do, here I should have explained a couple of more things, I guess. So let me do it here. So let's say this is my these are all my operators. I just draw it like that. No? So these are the operators that appear in this expansion. And now I have N of them. Okay, now I want to make L of them, but so I will append this space. So this was N here, and now I'm up to L. So now I append with unit operators. This is just one, so unit operator doesn't do anything. I can just stick that in there, and I have some more states that I put between here. They don't do anything. But now I want to do something more. I will not just have these guys in the end here. I want to allow them to appear anywhere. So I could have one unit operator there, and there could be another H here instead. So now I always have N H operator and L minus N unit operators in this sequence. And I want to let them be everywhere. And okay, also, H is a sum over some HI, where these, when we talk about the spin system, they would be these SZ, SZ terms, and the S plus, S minus terms. It's the individual bond operators. So what I show down here is what I get if I do all that. So first I insert these unit operators. And then I let them be everywhere. If I let them be everywhere, of course, there's I have to take into account that I can put them in many places. And how many places can I put them in? I can put them in L choose N different places, which is L factorial over L minus N factorial N factorial. That's how many places there are to distribute these unit operators. So if I allow them to be everywhere, I overcount, and I need to compensate for that. So I need to divide this factor here by by that number, and you see that this is what I get, divided by what I have up there on the board. And then what I have done here is just for formal simplicity, the unit operators I will call H0. So H0 is a unit operator. Any other H is some term in the Hamiltonian. So then I need to sum in these H's, I sum over all the possible terms in the Hamiltonian. So what I get for a given term over all those sum over Hamiltonian operators is something like this. So this H I1, I2, and so on, these refer to either a unit operator or an operator in the Hamiltonian, and this is just a way, the summing over all HI is just to indicate that you sum over all possible sequences of these operators. So it will be clearer when we actually show an example. Up to this point, it's completely general. When I wrote down some of these expressions, I did assume already that everything is positive definite, although it looks like we have a minus sign there. Now when we look at an example, we will see exactly when we have positive definiteness and when we don't. Okay, so let's do that, unless there are any questions about this general scheme. All right. Yeah? Well, okay, so that was because I wanted to avoid having a space that fluctuates inside. So if I sum over all these expansion orders, which I should do in the Taylor expansion, when I want to represent these terms in the computer, I will have to have the possibility of shrinking and expanding that space, which would be shrinking or expanding some array where I keep these things. Well, you can do it in various ways, of course. But the point is I want to fix that to L. So see, what I have done here, there is no longer any formal summation over N here. So here we have the Taylor expansion. Well, actually there is, because I made a mistake. This should not look like that anymore. Actually, it should just be there should be no sum here, and this thing should be inside here. See, when you write it in this way, there will be a fluctuating number of actual Hamiltonian operators there. So N now should refer to the number of actual Hamiltonian operators, so disregarding the unit operators. So basically counting in that array how many H operators I have. I think it will be clearer when we do the actual example. So let's look at the spin 1/2 Heisenberg model, which is the model we talk mainly about here, which looks like this. Now, the way I write it is in a dimensionality or lattice independent form, because I sum over bonds. So a bond or link on the lattice connects two sites, and those I call IB and JB. And again, we could use this labeling scheme that we already have seen. So for B equals 6, for example, sites 6 and 7 are connected. For B equals 27, 11 and 15 are connected, and so on. So now I want to define the operators that I called HI before. And I actually want to have them refer to bond operators, these Heisenberg bond operators, but I want to separate the diagonal ones and the off-diagonal ones. So let's first look at the off-diagonal ones. So this is the, for a given bond, the spin-flipping term. We have seen it many times before. And let me define H1B as the diagonal term, but I actually define it, as you see, with a minus sign, and I add a constant. And adding a constant to the Hamiltonian, you can always do, right? There's no problem with that. And in a moment, you will see why I did it. So the Hamiltonian with these definitions will look like that. So now I pull out the minus sign there, which compensates for that minus sign. So I have H1B here. And now I put a minus sign in front of H2B, because that should be plus, and I have a minus sign there. And then this is just the constant correcting for that term there. Okay? Let's look at the matrix elements of these operators. And now, because I have put this constant here, and I have defined this with a minus sign here, you see that there are four matrix elements that are non-zero of these operators. And all of them have the value 1/2. And I think you can imagine that that will be useful in a moment, that all the non-zero elements, matrix elements, actually have exactly the same value. So if we look at the partition function now, so this is still with this fluctuating space. And what I have done is written the trace as a sum over diagonal matrix elements, but I did not stick in those complete sets of states. It turns out that's, well, we can do it, but we actually don't have to do it. So let's look at what this is actually. Okay, so it's the Taylor expansion. Now, that minus sign there cancels the minus beta in the exponential. So we have e to the minus beta times h, so minus beta times minus j, that's just canceling that sign. But we do have another sign here. So for a given number of off-diagonal operators in this sequence, I get minus 1 to n2, where n2 is the number of those operators. So what this means is it's a sequence of these operators. So it came from h to the n, which I expanded in all possible combinations of those operators. And the first index here refers to diagonal or off-diagonal. The second index refers to the bond label. And then we have summed over all states to take the trace. And this is just formally the summation over all the possible combinations of these operators. So we can think of S, N as an index sequence of length N that corresponds to those operators. So what we're doing here is we have a state, and now we work with spins, so this will be just spins up and down. And then we act with a string of operators. And of course, what these operators can do, they can either do nothing, like these diagonal operators. Well, they have to, if they act somewhere, they have to act on parallel anti-parallel spins. And then we have these off-diagonal operators, which will flip spins. So we get some configurations where we start with a spin state, and then some spins can be flipped in it, and then in the end we take the matrix element. So that means that this state has to be propagated back to exactly the same state, and then we get a non-zero matrix element. And N2 counts the number of these spin-flipping operators we have here. Okay, let's look at the picture. Let's first look at this fixed length thing. So now, to fix the length of the expansion again, cut it at L, do the same trick as before. And now you see I have, something wrong in this sum because I have this SL summation twice. So this should not be there, the second one. Actually, let's look at the picture. It's much clearer. So what do we do? This is the state that I called alpha. So this is a spin state of eight spins. Red and white correspond to up and down, of course. These bars here correspond to those operators that I have in the sequence. So a white bar will be a diagonal matrix element, and since those non-zero elements that I showed you, they are always the ones where the spins are anti-parallel. These white bars can only be located between unequal spins. So this is one state, alpha. The operator acts, I get another state. These are what I call the propagated states here. So if I just take part of this string of operators here, when it has acted, I get some state that I call alpha p. So if the first operator acts, this is the state I get, and nothing changed in it. Here I have an off-diagonal operator, a black bar, and obviously that one flips the spin. And then I have nothing here, and the nothing corresponds to the unit operator. So in this operator string, there was a unit operator at position 2, so there's nothing there. And then again, there's a spin flip operator. And you see in this case, as it should be, the first and last states here are the same. If they are not the same, the matrix element vanishes, right? So if I remove, for example, this flip operator here, that would mean that those spins will be red-white instead of white-red, and then the matrix element is non-zero. So, well, so you can think of it as having periodic boundary conditions in this direction. If you wrap it around here, there has to be periodic boundary conditions. And so I hope this makes it clear now what this expansion is. So now if we write a program, we want to store these things in some way. So these are the A and B labels that correspond to the operators. You see one is diagonal, two is off diagonal, and if there's zero, there is no operator at all there. And B is the bond on which the operator acts. So for example, here it acts on the second bond. So here will be the first bond. This is the second bond. Okay, in the computer we can store this in a more compact way. Let me get to that in a minute. We can store it in a compact way, just instead of storing two integers, we can say, well, okay, if it's diagonal, let's just store it as twice that number. And if it's off diagonal, let's make it odd. So even and odd would be corresponding to diagonal or off diagonal. That's just one way to do it. So I call this S of P. So formally it would be 2 times B plus A minus 1. So that makes it even and odd for diagonal and off diagonal operators. And this spin state, we only have to store this spin state. We actually never have to store all these spin states. So we just store one of them, and later we will see how to work with them. Well, now let's get to this issue about the signs. So in principle, there is this sign here, which is just coming from the off-diagonal operators. And, this was also one reason that I added something here. If I had not added any constant here, there would also be some signs coming from the diagonal operators, right? Because if I act diagonally on two parallel spins, that would give a matrix element. If I still define it with the minus sign, it would give minus half here. So this constant here is quite important. It, in principle, it the only requirement is that it's chosen in such a way that all matrix elements are positive, but there's an added benefit of making it 1/4 that you will see in a moment, which makes all the matrix elements equal to each other, equal to 1/2. Yep. And which N2? So that's the number of these spin flip operators we have here. So in this configuration, N2 will be 4. So each spin flip gives you a minus sign, really. So and that really comes from this minus sign here. So it's because we have an antiferromagnetic interaction. If we had a ferromagnetic interaction, the spin flip would actually give you a plus. But in the case of the antiferromagnet, it gives us a minus. Okay, so in principle, this can be a problem, right? So, but you can see here in this kind of picture, I think you can convince yourself that we have to have an even number of these spin flippers in order for that state to be the same as that state. And that turns out to be true for any bipartite lattice. So a 1D chain with nearest neighbor interactions, 2D square lattice, 3D, other bipart lattices, where of course bipartite means that there are two sublattices, and in the interaction one site is on one sublattice, the other site is on a different sublattice. Right. Okay, but if we don't have a bipartite lattice, a triangular lattice would be the simplest example of that. Then we have a problem, and this is illustrated here. Let's look at just 3 spins on a triangle. So now, let's imagine a configuration like this, but since now I need to draw the triangle instead of just a straight line, I put the states next to each other like this instead, but it corresponds to the same as here. So the triangle, that's the first state. And then an operator is acting, and now I just put the operator here inside the triangle itself. So this is an operator flipping those two spins. So then I get that state. Then I flip those two spins. Then I get this state. And then I flip those two spins. Then I get this one. And obviously, these two are the same states. And I accomplish that by flipping three times. So here, N2 equals 3. And clearly, that's an odd number. And this is really the sign problem, and it's really as simple as that. So if you understand this, you understand the sign problem. So it's something that occurs for frustrated models. So as we have discussed before, the triangular antiferromagnet is a frustrated model. Now you may, so here it's very clear in this stochastic series expansion formulas why you get the sign problem. Well, if you go back to the path integral, it's not so clear. Well, because we didn't discuss it so clearly. You could repeat all this for a Heisenberg model. Here we did the hardcore bosons, which corresponds to the XY model. And it was actually the XY ferromagnet. Right? Now, if I had done the XY antiferromagnet, I would have a plus sign here. And that would, again, lead to some signs here, so there would be actually exactly the same thing. There would be a minus 1 to nk as well. So each movement of the boson, or if we call it spins, it would be spin flips. So if we do spins, every empty site here would be a down spin, right? So I could draw an open circle there to make that clearer, but it doesn't matter. So every flip leads to a minus sign. And okay, we take the continuum limit. Doesn't matter, that sign still stays there. So in the end, it's exactly the same thing. And in fact, these two formulations, the path integral and the series representation, you can see that they are really the same. I mean, the pictures that we would draw look identical, in fact. The difference is just in the factors that we associate with each configuration. So in the path integral, when we did interactions, we have something like that, and okay, exactly what it is depends on exactly what the Hamiltonian is, but it's some exponential of something times something else. So there's some weight, and that weighting is actually different in the two. So in the series expansion, we have these factorials here and the powers of beta. You can exactly relate those if you take the continuum limit in the path integral and you take this L to infinity here, you can exactly see in the end that it would be the same. But the advantage of this series approach is exactly that it gives you the exact result even in a discrete representation. So here everything is discrete. We have a number of operators. And as long as we cut that expansion at some order proportional to n times beta, we will have no error, or an error which is so small that you can absolutely neglect it. And recall that this is also the number of kinetic jumps or spin flips, whatever we have, in the path integral formalism. So in the path integrals, if we go to the continuum, we store these events, and we have to store proportional to n times beta of those events. And here we also have to store, we store operators, but the operators correspond to events. Right? There are, for example, here you see that when an operator acts, there's an event in the picture here. Something moves. We also store, in this case, diagonal operators. So they are sort of events where nothing happens. So we have to store a little bit more events here because we have the diagonal ones. But the advantage is that when we start to update these configurations, if we do it in the continuum path integral formalism, we have to deal with some floating point numbers, and the probabilities involved are more complicated. Here the probabilities involved are always very simple due to the fact that this is still a discrete representation, and we have very simple combinatorial factors here. So this SSE approach, at least for most spin systems, it would be faster. There are some cases with bosons, depending on the interactions and so on, where it would actually be better to do the path integral. But here we are talking about spins, so we will actually implement this SSE formalism. Yeah? Well, this is Euclidean time, in some sense. I mean, when we did the path integral, it was really explicitly Euclidean time, imaginary time. And here, this is not time, right? It's, but as I just explained, I mean, this is very much related to Euclidean time. So in fact, if you take some difference between two states here, you can relate it to time, to imaginary time. So if you take if you want a fixed imaginary time, it actually corresponds to a distribution of separations here. But this is very close to Euclidean time. And still there are negative signs. So it's even in, if you do a path integral in Euclidean time, sometimes it's not positive definite. And there is, nobody knows how to cure that. I mean, it's a fundamental thing about quantum mechanics, so it's clearly not easy to get rid of, and it just happens. Well, there's some deep reason, of course, but for these bipartite spin systems, we can easily get rid of the sign problem just by this trick of adding a constant to the diagonal operator, or in the path integral, it happens automatically, more or less. Of course, this is all basis dependent, so if you have a case like this where you have a sign problem, you can think, well, how about if I go to another basis? So here I just use the basis of up and down spins. And maybe there's some better basis that I could use to get rid of the sign problem. In some cases, that's the case. You can find examples where just by going to a more complicated basis, you can solve some sign problems. But those cases are typically very special. So there's no generic known way how to transform away this sign problem. So that means that right now, fundamentally, quantum Monte Carlo is limited to some classes of models. But for those models, we can do things that is completely impossible with other methods. We can really get to really large lattices and so on. Okay, so what I should say, stress again, is that this SSC is a representation of the imaginary time continuum. So it is a representation of Euclidean time, but it's a discrete representation of it. And the advantage is that there's not much floating point operations to do in the program. So let's look at how we would actually start to make a program here. Let me first talk a little bit more about this, about how to store the configuration. Okay, sorry, let me flip back to the previous one. So if you look at this picture here, as I already said, you don't want to store all these states. In fact, if you store just one state and the operators, that completely determines all those other states, right? Because you can generate them by just acting with these operators on the states. So when we need the states, we can generate them. On the other hand, there are some cases where we want to store a little bit more. So let's say if we want to store a little bit more here. There's clearly some redundant information here. So here, two spins are flipped, and then nothing happens with those two spins until they are flipped again here. So one storage that we want to use actually stores these operators and their spin states, but then instead of storing everything that's between, we want to, in the computer, in the program, we want to make a link. So we want to make it possible to sort of move from this part of the space to that part of the space without stepping through all these other states, just moving with a link. So how do we do that? So this picture here shows that reduced representation where I took away all the redundant spins. So these lines here represent the links, and the spin states are exactly the same all through the link. So the end points of a link always are in the same state, and in between, whatever spins are there do not change. So how do we store these links? Well, now you can make some sophisticated ways, of course, with pointers and so on. The way I prefer to do it is something simpler, which is faster. So normally here we are aiming for speed because we want to do big systems and so on. So the way I do these links is the following. So again, we have some labeling, or we store these operators in some one-dimensional array, and I store them in locations 0 to 11 here. So here there are 12 operators, and you see some of them are empty, so they would be zeros in those locations. Now I also want to store these what I call vertices. So if you look at what is a vertex, so the vertices correspond to the allowed matrix elements. So these are the diagonal operators. They can appear between antiparallel spins, and they don't do anything. They just sit there. The off-diagonal operators flip the spins. I call these the legs of the vertices, and I can label the legs 0, 1, 2, 3, for example, in this fashion. So now what I want, since I want to be able to move around in this space, and later you will see why, I want to store all these vertices and their legs, and I want to be able to move between them. So let's look at how this list goes. So now, since I have four legs for each vertex, I'm going to have four times the number of operators, so many legs. So I number them, so let's look at this one. I number, so they are all stored in a 1D sequence, but I here have subdivided in four pieces. But you see here numbering 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on. So you can think of this as a one-dimensional array, and the gray is just the location in that 1D array, and these in the white boxes is what's actually stored there. So let's see what's stored in the first four positions. It's going to be the links from those legs. So this corresponds to the first element, the leg 0. It says here 35. So that means, that means that leg should be linked to leg 35. And where is leg 35? That's up here. And it corresponds to that operator. So you see that this, the boundary conditions are periodic here. So whatever goes out here goes out back in there. So you see that that leg is actually connected to that leg there. And that's leg 3 of that vertex, so it should be here, right? So if I'm at this leg, what I would do in this array is I would be here, and then it would tell me, okay, I have to jump to 35 if I want to go there, and 35 is, again, where is it? Here. And that contains 0 because that leg is linked to that leg. So is this clear or completely confusing? Yeah. Let me show you, because what we are going to do is we are going to do some updates. We are going to do some changes here. So I will need this when I'm actually going to create what's called loop updates. So the point is that we want to not be able just to move between these links, but for example, we can imagine that we want to do something like that. We want to start here. We want to move there. Then we want to move there and back again, and have a closed loop. And that was just one example, and let me show you why we want to do that. Now it's again a case where I don't want to get into too many details because I think it's too fast anyway. So I want to give you the flavor of it. Then you will, in the tutorial on Thursday, you will actually play with the program. And really the program is quite short, and I will show you some pseudocodes quickly. And the program is written pretty much following those pseudo codes. So there will be one subroutine where this linked list is constructed. And I will flash the pseudo code for it, but I will not discuss it in detail. But I hope the idea is clear here, that we have this configuration. we have a lot of redundant information, and let's say I want to flip all the spins that are between here. Then I just need to flip these two, and everything is then implicitly flipped in between, and I need to go between them. And anywhere you look here, you will find a link. So for example, this leg here is leg number two, so I should look at the third column here, so two, yeah, because, the second column, they're labeled from 0, 1, 2, 0, 1, 2, 3, so this is the column I should look at. That leg, so this column, it says go to 29, I go to 29, it's here. So it's in the first column, that means it's leg number one of that operator. So it's seven. Yeah, so it's there. It's that leg. So it's indeed linked there. Okay, so that's how that works.
So you still need to know the specific spin you're connected to. You still need to look at the operator list as well.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So yeah, this does not contain whether the operator is diagonal or off diagonal. That will still be in that list, but that's accessible just through this index. So there will be two alternative storage facilities here. So you will see that, but thanks for the question. Okay, so let's go back to the original storage. And let me talk about one way to update. So there will be a couple of different ways to update this configuration space. And this is the simplest one, which we call the diagonal update. So now what we store in the computer is just that list that I showed you before, which I should have repeated here, but it's just the list of these operators, a one-dimensional list containing the type and location of the operators. So in general, what we do in Monte Carlo simulation, as you remember from the Ising model, we have a configuration and then we do some change to it. Now, I denote my configuration by alpha and SL, and alpha refers to the state that we have stored. We have just stored one state. And SL refers to this list of operators, just a list of those integers. And this is the weight for a configuration. So now it was very convenient that all these matrix elements are one half, so each operator that is allowed, meaning that it sits between antiparallel spins, gives a half. And then there was beta there, so it's beta over half, over 2 to the power of n, and then there was this combinatorial factor. So that's the weight of the configuration. So let's look at what we do in you remember we discussed detailed balance and the acceptance probability. So let's see, because maybe I should write down the detailed balance again, maybe you remember it. So the detailed balance in general, if I just write it like this, P of A to B divided by P of B to A should be equal to the weight of B divided by the weight of A. And now, as you remember, this P is really, you should think of it as a product of two factors. The probability of selecting a change and the probability of finally accepting the change. And in the case of the Ising model, this select probability was always the same because we just generated a site at random, so the probability was 1 over n. So that completely cancelled out when we did the ratio of the probabilities. But in this case, what we want to do is something like this. We want to, if I just think of what we are doing in this space, although we will not here store all the states, we want to be able to remove and add diagonal operators. That's what this first update does. So when we come here, we want to have the possibility of just removing that operator, meaning we put in one of those unit operators instead. When we come here, we are not going to do anything because that's a diagonal, an off-diagonal operator. When we come here, we want to try to put in a diagonal operator, which we could do, for example, here or here, and so on. So what we want to do at each step is, where we can, is one of these. Either insert an operator or remove an operator. But now you can see that there's an imbalance here. Because when we remove an operator, we just, it corresponds to putting a unit operator there. So there's just one way to do that. There's just one way to remove that. That's it. If we insert an operator, we have many ways to do that, right? We can, because we can put it in different places. We can put it here, 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 or here. And in fact, what we will do, we are going to generate the location at random. So there are actually n places where we can try to put it. Well, some will not be allowed. So for example, if we try to put it there later, we can actually not do it. But at least we want to try all the positions. So there are actually n ways to insert and just one way to remove. So there's an imbalance. But that is exactly what this pselect is. So pselect, if we go from, so this means the unit operators, if we go to from unit operator to diagonal operator, the probability is 1 over nb, where nb is the number of bonds, which in 1D is just equal to n, in 2D it will be 2n. And when we remove, the probability is just 1. So these select probabilities now actually come into play, and we have to keep them there. Then we have to compute the weight ratios, and those are very simple because the weight is just like that. So it's just, if we add an operator, n increases by 1, and if we remove, n decreases by 1. So finally, if we do that, these are the acceptance probabilities for doing the diagonal updates, and they are very, very simple. But what you, yeah, please.
Why are you neglecting the fact that there are some positions that you cannot?
I was just going to come to that. Good. So we generate it among all the possibilities. But then if, for example, here, if I put it here, the acceptance probability would actually be 0. So this is the acceptance probability where it's actually allowed. So if I generate it there, I will not do it and just move on to the next one. Because the weight would be 0 for that case. So it's completely in accordance with this. Okay, but that's a good point, because that also means that I need to know this state, because I need to know where I can put it and not. And I just told you I'm not going to store all these states. But that's fine, because I'm going to first store this state. And then as I move up, so I'm going to do these moves successively, starting from here and going up. Every time I encounter an off-diagonal operator, I cannot do that kind of update, but I need to flip the two spins. So I store this state, and then I flip the spins, so then I actually store that state. And then I go on, and I always keep the state I get as I propagate. And when I'm done, I'm actually back to the same state again. So I will just have to store one at a time so that I can know where I can put the operator. Okay, so in these updates, n goes to n plus 1 or n minus 1. So if I had done it with this fluctuating length space, it would mean, well, it still means increasing or decreasing the Taylor expansion by 1. So you see that automatically it does the Taylor expansion for you. Maybe it's time to stop. Good point. All right, so let's next time discuss how to implement it quickly. And all right. Well, okay, one more question. Yeah.
If you look at the last state and the last state, what made you division in these two states? Because if I remove the top, I just get something which is similar to the bottom.
Let's see. So, okay, so you have a fixed space, right? So when we start, there's no operator there. And then we start to put in these diagonal operators like this. Next time we will talk about how to insert and remove off-diagonal operators. But the point is, you always have to keep the constraint that state is the same as that state. You only store one, but in the end, you always keep the constraint that this is a periodic.
And what I'm saying is that if I remove the last line...
But why would you remove it?
I see. They are the same. So
Oh, I see. Well, okay. So this is just a picture. Okay. It's just because when I wrote those expressions like this, I write alpha here and alpha here. So, and well, if we go back even more, I mean, it corresponds to this notation here, right? So I have the state alpha naught, and then some other states, and then I have alpha naught again. But you're right, they are the same states. So I don't have to, but yeah, it's just for clarity and to conform to exactly this. All right, let's continue tomorrow.